Welcome to A Fine Time for Healing, a place where your physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being are all that matter. So put your feet up, relax, and enjoy today's show. Today we're going to be talking about a topic that I find super interesting, and that is energy therapies, how important they are, and how they have been taboo in the West. Meaning the US, for many, many years. And so we're making progress with energy medicine. But Dr. Rick Leskowitz is with us today, and he's going to be, he wrote this book called The Mystery of Life Energy. And he's talking about biofield healing, phantom limb pain, group energies, Gaia consciousness. Eric. Rick Leskowitz, MD, is a retired Harvard Medical School affiliated psychiatrist who practices, he actually practiced pain management for over 25 years at Spaulding Rehabilitation Hospital in Boston. He has published over 50 articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals and is the author, editor of four books, including this book, The Mystery of Life Energy. His documentary about group energies in sports, The Joy of Socks, aired nationally on PBS in 2012, and he lives in Western Massachusetts. Well, we're going to learn more about Dr. Leskowitz right now. Welcome. It's so great to have you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to be here.
Sure. What got you interested in life energy, the energy force, and energy medicine, and things like that?
Well, it actually was a bit of a journey, as they say, because I grew up believing in mainstream science where everything was broken down into micro parts and look at under a microscope and understand. And I thought life energy was bogus, it was totally BS back then. I had a few life experiences that changed things for me. One important step that I realized looking back on it was that I took time off between college and medical school. Like college, I did pre-med and was figuring on going to medical school. But this was in the late 60s and early 70s, and there was a spirit of sort of activism and anti-war, anti-establishment thinking. So questioning authority was a big part of it, but I was only thinking of it politically, not in terms of people. But I did some traveling. I took a couple of years off and went overseas, and many important things happened, including meeting my wife, but we also had an opportunity to travel overland to India and just saw that people do things differently. So I came back to medical school knowing that we didn't have the full picture. A bit of an outlier because most people had just gone straight on the conveyor belt, if you want to put it like that. But then I had learned how to, and when we traveled, it wasn't like a spiritual quest or anything like that. It was just curiosity about other ways of doing things. I learned how to meditate before starting medical school. So that was a little bit of a, as the British say, it was the thin end of the wedge. And
This was transcendental meditation, TM. Is that what you learned?
was TM was the
Right, that was the thing.
that was the thing back then. It was because of the Beatles and
Right.
that
I mean,
whole.
I'm trained in TM too. I know how to do
Oh, so, and it was very valuable tool. I
that.
learned it more as stress management than anything else, but it really opened the door to a lot of ways of doing things. And so in medical school, I was very curious what effect would meditation have on this disease or that disease. And of course, nobody knew because it was very, very new. And but at least it was the idea was that your mind could affect your body. And that was something that I took with me into my psychiatry training, which happened to be a program where the founder of psychoneuroimmunology was the department chair. And
Oh,
so
wow.
that made it a little more scientific and medicalized. And that was great. And that was kind of as far as I was needing to go. My first job was in the VA healthcare system in Boston, treating vets who had PTSD. And honestly, we didn't really know what to do, but it was well intended. But a friend of mine invited me to go to a lecture by a visiting healer from California. And that sort of triggered all pushed all my buttons and triggered all this stuff about healer and laying on of hands and come on, that's. But I trusted my friend, so I went. And this was Reverend Rosalind Bruyere, came over from Los Angeles, and she was the real deal. She worked with the medical system in Los Angeles because the doctors knew her and trusted her, and she could see things and sense things that the doctors couldn't. And basically, she was working with the energy level of things that just was not a part of medical school. We're very mechanistically oriented, materialist, and if you can't see it with the five physical senses, it's not real and it's not worth paying attention to. But that left us as the outliers. The rest of the world has their healing systems have, in the yoga tradition, they have prana. In traditional Chinese medicine, they have qi. So it's everywhere but here. So I, she was a real eye-opener. And that sort of set up a parallel track through the rest of my career, that there was the mainstream view of things. But what is the energy perspective on this? And because I ended up working in pain management, energy turned out to be really, really, really important. And that sort of led to some of the things that I talk about in the
Yeah,
book.
it's difficult to go through medical school when you have this other point of view. So it really takes a broader perspective, but you still have to really focus on what they're telling you because you got to get through medical school, right?
That's true. Yeah, I mean,
Holistics are not, holistic medicine is not part of it, really. It's a tiny little
well, it's changing a lot. I think, retiring and sitting back and writing the book has helped me appreciate just how much it actually has changed.
Okay.
Like, take meditation, for example. That was very flaky back then. But I run at UMass, actually, there was a junior faculty member who was in, I think, physiology department, I don't actually remember, but he would give brown bag lunch and talks to faculty about his outside interest in meditation. And he got to wondering what effect would it have on patients. And so I and a couple of medical students helped connect him up with one of the primary care docs in the outpatient clinic. And he did his first pilot study showing that mindfulness can be helpful. And from that, he's built like this was Jon Kabat-Zinn. And so back then, nobody knew about any of this, but now there are literally thousands of research studies on the effect of meditation. So it's changed a lot, a lot, a lot, a lot.
And I know that Reiki practitioners are invited into many hospitals to practice there.
Yeah, that's sort of the next step. Mind-body things was one step, but then this whole idea of energy, that's been it was sort of next step, and it's happening as you say. It actually started at an affiliated Boston hospital, Brigham and Women's. One of their staff members was trained in Reiki and had the idea of inviting volunteers in from the community just in the evenings, not official treatment plans, but to give sessions for patients and family and staff. And it became so popular that it spread through other, spread everywhere. Because something happens when you experience this. It's more than just somebody putting their hands on your shoulders. And the question is, what is actually going on? And there's actually a lot of research that clinical benefits and mechanism of action. And I think the energy stuff is sort of the next step in our fuller understanding of what we're all about.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And you start your book talking about the emerging views of energy. And the first, you go back to Franz Anton Mesmer, who was an 18th century German doctor. He discovered animal magnetism, and this turned the medical world upside down. Tell us about what his theories were and how important that was in what we know today.
Well, he was a bit ahead of his time, and for better or worse, this was in the era when people were just learning about electricity and magnetism, and Benjamin Franklin flying the kite with the key, and what's lightning and all that. This was all new,
Right.
and he very interested in magnetism in particular. There were stones, naturally occurring magnets called lodestone, and it was part of his model. He had been interested in medical astrology and the influence of the planets on humans, and he developed this whole model of a force that connects people, that he actually said it ch travels through channels in the body. You know, he didn't call it acupuncture meridians. He didn't know about that, but he developed a treatment technique where not just a magnet, but his hands, he felt, could have an animal magnetism just like a stone could have. And he began treating patients in Paris. Actually, he married a wealthy French widow, and that became his basis. But he was so successful in literally in stealing patients from wealthy patients from the doctors, that there was sort of a rebellion, and they set up a commission, royal commission, to examine his work. And because of how it was set up, it was destined to prove that his stuff didn't work. Yeah, because they didn't choose. He was not the person who demonstrated the therapy. It was a doctor who was given a kind of a mixed message about if you know what's good for you, you'll prove that this is bogus. And so he was, they found that it was a negative findings, and he was kind of shamed and run out of town. But the stuff lingered because it worked. There were mesmeric infirmaries throughout Europe. A British naval surgeon described how he used these hand passes over the body, mesmeric passes, to generate surgical level anesthesia that he could operate under. And it was still widely used until, I should know the date, I think it was 1854, something like that, when chemical anesthesia using ether became the norm. And it was instantly, because it worked so quickly, and you didn't need to spend hours getting into that state. So it took over right away, and mesmerism and animal magnetism has faded away until much, much, much more recently, when now there are a lot of clinical applications of, small magnets, pulsed magnetic fields to treat depression, things like that. So he's getting vindicated. What is it? 200 years too late for him to know about it, but it's good to see that it's happening.
That's really interesting. So you say that despite their widely varying origins, many of these terms have begun to creep into our everyday vocabulary. So I wanted to just mention a couple of these because I think that we all hear these things, and I don't know that we understand its relevance to energetic medicine. So, qi or qi, which is traditional Chinese medicine. Then there's ki, which is Japanese Zen. Prana, which is Ayurvedic. Ruach, Kabbalistic Judaism. Orenda, that's one that I hadn't heard. Iroquois. The spiritual force that flows through all living beings. And there's a bunch of them. Wakantanka, Huna, Baraka, Manitou, Orisha, Moho. And then you say, and then finally, two terms from the Western European mystical tradition are pneuma and spirit. So what is pneuma?
Well, we know it as, it's a Greek word that means air and breath, so pneumonia, the lungs, that kind of thing. But it was their term for the invisible spirit. I think it's, I'm going out on a limb here, but I think it's actually pronounced pneuma because of how their
Oh,
vowel,
really?
but it's what gave root to so many of our words. And so it's parallel to spirit, which is the Latin word for it. And that's an interesting word too, because it can mean things like spiritual, which is the higher dimension, but respiration, it means the breathing. But also, my favorite sort of derivative of that is the word that conspiracy. Conspiracy is when people breathe together. Literally, that's what it means.
That's what
Con
it means? Wow.
meanings together, and spiro is breathing. So that's the essence of it.
Conspiracy.
So if you're starting to breathe together with somebody, you're in a conspiracy.
That's great. That's
It's
cool.
pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but just because, but it didn't really become part of our medicine, because we're very good at breaking things down into parts. And, the heart is a pump, and the eye is a camera, and things like that. And there is a lot of truth to that. There's, to a certain degree, that is true. And you replace the broken parts or the missing parts, and things will get better. I mean, I tell the story. I tore my knee ligament a while ago, and For a day, I was trying to do self-healing and meditation and imagery and visualization and stuff like that. But I realized, come on, get real. It's not gonna do anything. So I had knee surgery and it fixed it and I recovered and it's fine. So in its place, it's great. But in modern medicine, we've become so reliant on surgery and medicines that we omit all, even just simple lifestyle things. Like, for example, during COVID, the vaccine was away the number one priority. There was almost nothing mentioned about some of the main risk factors like obesity, low vitamin D levels. Those are things that public health measures could have addressed so that each person's own immune resilience could be enhanced. But it was all focused on something external that was done to you. And there's problems with that. Not even talking about safety and efficacy. The problem is that you put your faith into something external and you believe your health depends on something outside of you. So it's very disempowering to the individual person. And it was very lucrative for, the whole financial economic side of it is that's a whole other story. But from my point of view, it totally omitted the way that people can self-heal and be resilient because of how they circulate their energy.
I so agree with you. This bothered me so much because I know there are things that we can do to boost our immune system. There's ways that we can do this, but it was so fear-based that people felt like they just had to do what they were told to do. But very few, there might have been doctors who were talking about things like zinc and, things that support the immune system. But that's not what the mainstream was. I never believed in the vaccine. I never took the vaccine. I have never had COVID. I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. Fear was a big part of it. And how much of that was intentional or accidental, that gets into
Conspiracy.
the meta. Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah, the meta politics of it. But it did create a state where people didn't trust their own abilities anymore. And a lot of doctors were marginalized, even for simple things like suggesting vitamins, let alone the ivermectin and that whole story. So there was a lot of political power play involved in how that turned out.
Right. Exactly. It divided families.
Yeah.
It did a lot of damage to us. So there, we talked about that. Okay. I like how you talked about Woody Allen's movie and the Orgasmatron. I remember that movie. I remember watching that. And you're referring to Wilhelm Reich, Reich, Reich? Okay, whatever. So what was he introducing?
Well, he's another Western-trained physician who delved into the area of energies, invisible energies, and he also came up against a lot of establishment flak. He was actually a student of Sigmund Freud, and to be fair to Sigmund Freud, he was one of the first energy medicine practitioners because he talked about libido as being this motive force. For him, it could be directed in many different directions and ego defenses to keep it in balance. But Wilhelm Reich took it very directly to its sexual origins, called it orgone energy based on the orgasm, that the flow of that energy he thought was the key to health. So he had a lot of exercises and to keep your muscles from spasming up and things like that. But he also thought it was out there in the world, in the air. And he developed these simple devices to collect the orgone. And there's one illustration in the book. It shows a woman just literally sitting in a box. It's a large box, small, it looks like a small closet or something. It's made up of layers of wood, metal, cotton, metal like that. And shouldn't be anything except a room, but people felt charged up buy this orgone energy. And so he was using this to treat everything from cold to cancer. I'm into trouble because the FDA cracked down on him. He refused to comply, and this is kind of amazing. They actually ended up arresting him. He was imprisoned. His books were burned.
Oh my gosh.
America had a book burning, and Fahrenheit 451 happened in
That
19.
what is that what for Fahrenheit 451 was about?
No, it wasn't about medical. That was more about a political, anything that challenged the political powers that be would be burned.
Okay.
But to show that this could really happen. And now there's a lot of concern about censorship and other forms. So he was in prison when he actually died in prison a few days before his parole hearing was scheduled to happen. So he was a martyr to the cause of energy. His idea that psychotherapy should focus on what happens in the body led to the whole school of body-centered psychotherapy.
Right.
There's a the best book on trauma, PTSD and trauma is about how the body keeps the score by Bessel van
Yes.
der Kolk. That's just another modern day version of it. So here's another guy who was way ahead of his time and faced consequences. I think it's much, much different now. Things like acupuncture have gotten accepted and validated by studies, and people believe in it. Medicare will pay for it in certain situations. So it's a very different era now. It's now it's these sort of these non-contact therapies that are even the more challenging. But things are changing. I think in my book I talk about well, it was actually one particular patient encounter that, as I think about it, really changed things dramatically for me. I worked in a pain management program. Excuse me, and that meant with chronic pain patients who were not doing well with standard medicines and nerve blocks and whatnot. So they came to our program because we shifted the focus onto them. It was called self-management, where our team, which was physical therapists, occupational therapists, social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, and pain doctors, taught techniques that the patients would learn to use and implement in their life to take charge. And usually people did remarkably well. There was one particular guy who stands out because he didn't do well, but that wasn't why. It was because he agreed to have an energy therapy that I didn't routinely use. He was a fellow who had had he was in his 30s, I think, at work a crushing he was a working a stock room, and something fell on his leg and crushed it, and he had to have most of one leg amputated. And he had what unfortunately is a not unusual side effect of amputation, that he developed what's called phantom limb pain. Now, it's common for people after amputation to feel like the limb is still there. Not as common for it to be painful, but when it is, it's really hard to treat. It doesn't respond to the usual thing. So he wasn't doing that well in our program. So I had him lie down on the examining table and told him, just relax, Jim. I'm going to just be smoothing out. You may feel nothing at all, but just relax. So he did that, and I did the what's called therapeutic touch, which is actually a modern day version of what Mesmer did in smoothing out the space around. And actually, for reviewers, I can do a 30-second demo. You can feel something between your hands. If you start with your hands a few feet apart and bring them together without touching, going back and forth, and just even it's even better with your eyes closed. You can sort of at some point begin to feel something that's not the air moving, it's not the temperature. Some people feel it like a pressure or a tingling. And that is important in therapeutic touch. It's actually interesting to see what the distance is between your hands, because this is actually a crude measure of how big your energy field is, because your field here and your field here, the boundaries bump into each other and you can feel it. It's like, personal space. You can feel when somebody enters into your aura with or without your permission. So I was doing this smoothing out on him, and up the head and the chest, I could feel the very same pressure that you guys felt doing that. I continued down, and I still don't know why I did it, but I continued down to his missing leg. I did the same energy palpation on his missing leg and felt the exact same pressure sensation, even though his leg wasn't there anymore. And, you know, it was like, for me, it was like, whoa. And also at the same moment, he opened his eyes and he said, "What are you doing, doc?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "He could feel me touching his phantom leg."
Oh my gosh.
Well, that's pretty much what I was saying. That's a direct quote. Yeah, I mean, how can that be? Because, you know, there weren't any nerves anywhere near. It was
Right.
just empty space. To our eyes, it was just empty space. And yet he could feel something and I could feel something, and it corroborated. So from that moment on, I realized that the biofield is a real thing. It's not just some creation of the mind or, you know, different ways of dismissing it. So I finished the session by smoothing out the energy. He could feel his pain literally blowing out the bottom of his foot. And that turned out to be a common pattern in other types of pain as well, that when the energy builds up, it's uncomfortable. And also what I learned was that the energy often gets stuck there because of some emotional trauma, because surgeons are not particularly good at helping people process their emotions. It's not not what you want them to do either. So learning some energy-based techniques to release emotions had a huge impact on phantom limb pain. And one technique I'll mention in particular has to do with patient tapping his or her own acupuncture points. So it looks like something like this. It's part of the treatment session, but they're thinking about something that's upsetting them, feeling it, and making some statements of self-acceptance while they do this tapping. And it leads to we've all had the experience of, you know, that when you release some kind of emotional charge, it does that in a way that ties right into where the pain is coming from. So people would actually, over the course of several sessions, have their phantom limb pain relieved, or whatever sort of chronic pain they were having would be relieved. And it's, you know, it's pretty dramatic when it happens. It's very cool.
It is. I mean, in the late 70s, I developed chronic fatigue syndrome. And at that time, there really weren't many holistic treatments. And I remember a doctor put me on Valium. He's like, "You're depressed." No, that's not what it was. But it led me to pretty much a 40-year seeking of alternative therapies. And so one of the things that I found the most beneficial was acupuncture. And I started that when I was pregnant with my second child because I couldn't get out of bed. And my acupuncturist would come and do house calls
Oh, wow. Yeah, nice.
to sort of get me moving, you know. But it was something I stayed with for pretty much the rest of my life. I still do it. And Chinese medicine as well, I thought, you know, was really incredible. But over the years, I did Ayurvedic medicine, energies, different energies, because traditional Western medicine did not address my issues. And the chronic fatigue was sort of an autoimmune, and it, you know, it just kind of spread out into other autoimmune things and other issues like that. So, I'm completely on board that energy medicine and EFT tapping. I know that's one of the, and that's what you're talking about. The tapping is really taken on. A lot of practitioners are using it.
Yeah, it's become popular because it's effective, because it addresses the energy base of things like everything, chronic fatigue, depression. You know, they're all low energy states that you can, you know, you can have some coffee or some Ritalin or whatever to, you know, juice up the system, but it doesn't get to the root of it. And things like acupuncture will help you get to it, and so will energy therapies like EFT. For viewers who are interested in learning more about it, there's a really great organization. It's the Professional Organization for Energy Psychology, the Association for Comprehensive Energy Psychology, ACEP, ASEP. And their website has a lot of resources. The website is energypsych.org. And for people who want to see the research, there's It's actually very impressive how much has been generated in the last 10 or 20 years. There's demo videos and things like that. So it's a really good resource for people to check out.
Yeah, and I think I years back I had an integrative psychiatrist on my podcast, and I really love that theory because it's a whole body thing. It's not just chemical, brain chemical. Here's a drug, right? Do you do
Exactly.
integrate? Did you do integrative psychiatry?
Well, I focused on pain management, so I wasn't seeing people who were, bipolar or schizophrenic or things like that. But within that, we did because we would typically wean people off as many medications as possible, because it became the practice in psychiatry to prescribe multiple medications. When I did my training, this was in psychiatry training was 79 to 83. Talking was still the main intervention, and it was influenced by psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. Medications gradually made more and more of an inroad, I think partly because this sounds funny, but I think psychiatry had an inferiority complex compared to the rest of medicine, and they could be more legit in a way if they had some medicine to back up the
Okay.
word. So, but back then, if you prescribed somebody one or two medications, that was kind of the limit. And now it's not unusual to have six or seven or eight psych meds at the same time, and
I
it's just
know.
one
Wow.
side effect after another. And so it really muddies the water. So I tended not to prescribe, if at all possible, and to use some of these. We could, because we worked as a team. The physical therapist might have a stretching program that was shaded into yoga. The occupational therapist would teach them biofeedback to help regulate their autonomic nervous system. So it's a really nice model for working together as a team, a multidisciplinary team, because human beings are multidimensional, and you have to attend to body, energy, emotions, mind, and spirit, or else you're missing something. So it's coming along, but we're not there yet in terms of the healthcare system. But I can see the potential for it to happen.
I mean, I do. My expertise is in narcissistic abuse, and I coach people on healing from it. And so, and as a child, I had a narcissistic mother, so I've seen how my body has gone through, like all the things that have happened to me, not just mentally, but the whole physical part, the nervous system part, all of it. That has been lingering as a result of living in constant trauma or high energy or whatever it is, unpredictable energy. And I've realized that I think it starts really with our awareness of our thought process. But once we clear up the thought process, we then have the nervous system issues that have to be corrected, because that's like I know my nervous system never co-regulated to a normal range, never did. And then even if we get that straight, we still have the residual, the body keeps the score. Over the years, so I've done a lot of work to move through all of this, but the body part is really. It just keeps coming up and coming up and coming up. There's so much there. So we are, our bodies are very complicated, but I'm trained in polyvagal theory, and so I can work with people with their nervous systems, but it's we are really complicated beings, and there is no one approach that works for everything. So this, what you're telling me, the way that you approached pain management is just really awesome. People who had the advantage of being there with you were really, really fortunate.
Well, it's a program that's been around for, I don't know, it started like 30 years ago. Yeah, so it was there before I got there, so I didn't invent any of this. It's actually an outgrowth of work that Norm Shealy developed. He was a neurosurgeon who also became a PhD in psychology and was one of the founders of the American Holistic Medical Association. And he got interested in stress management and chronic pain, and he set up one of the first clinics with biofeedback as the primary treatment for chronic pain, which, you know, at the time sounded totally crazy, but
Right.
it had a profound effect on me. So there's different outgrowths of it. So our program has been around for over 40 years now, and you know, the whole idea of having a team treat it is really important too, because each person, each therapist works on a different component of the big picture, and no one person can do it all. So there are a lot of good things to be said for it. Originally, it was an inpatient program where patients came and stayed for a month. They did really well, but insurance companies began to balk because we really need this or we really need that. And so for a bunch of reasons, we transitioned to an outpatient program. It's not nearly as intensive, tried to include the key elements, but you know, it's the whole that gets into the whole economics of healthcare and insurance companies not wanting to cover an initial payment now, even though it'll save them so much down the road long term. And there were studies that documented just how much they would save, but they're just sitting right here and right now. And it's hard to make that shift.
So, if there are physiological issues that can be detected through X-ray or MRI or CAT scan or things like that, how does energy medicine work with that? So, like, I'm thinking, so I had, herniated discs in my back, in my neck, things like that. And I went through pain management, but I went through epidural pain management. So, how does energy healing work with something that is really physiologically there? It can be seen, it can be palpated.
Well, it's actually not as black and white as that, because there are some studies showing that people who have normal x-rays of the spine can have back pain. People who have noticeable findings on x-ray in their back have no pain. And maybe a third of the people are in the middle, you know, they'll have findings that match up with the x-ray. But it's not 100% correspondence, like I used to think that, you know, if you have a disc that's out of alignment, that's where you're going to hurt. And a lot of people have those findings on x-ray, but they don't feel any symptoms at all. So there's something else going on. And I think what energy does is wherever the blockage is, it could be literally mechanically a disc clogging up the works, but it could also be just muscle tension, closing down, you know, the fascial connections, closing down some of the meridians and making the flow current more difficult. But if you can get the energy to move, you can get the physiology to open up. And it's very interesting the connection between that energy is the connection between mind and body. This is something that there's a slogan in traditional Chinese medicine that the mind directs the qi, the energy, and the blood follows the qi. By blood, they mean the physiology, that the body takes its direction from how qi is going. So really, this energy is the link between mind and body, and it's what has puzzled, you know, Western medicine for so long. I mean, the polyvagal theory is really important, and obviously, the vagus nerve does play a key role. But what cues the vagus nerve to be activated or not? And we don't know the exact answer to that. How an energy shift causes this part of the brain or that part of the brain to respond. And that's, I think, where some really important work is going to be happening. But so, you know, we're gradually putting all the pieces together, and we're not there yet, but I think we can sort of see where it's heading.
Right. And you know, that explains that makes total sense to me because what I had, some people walk around and I was in absolute agony. I mean, I could not move. And other people walk around with it and doesn't bother them. But then in the same vein, my muscles are always in spasm and I don't even feel it because it's my norm. Like up here, my traps and everything. People put their hands on me, they're like, "Oh my gosh, Randy. How do you walk around like this? I don't feel it."
No, that's a good point. It's very individual, very unique. Each person's The nervous system gets adapted to it because of their beliefs. Different cultures have different relationship to pain and discomfort, and that conditions how you respond to it. So it has to be done on an individual basis for sure.
I love when you talked about the rotten apple experiment. Talk about that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, it's very important to show that energy has effects outside of the body too. And there's a couple of demonstrations, I guess, that I talked about in the book. And the one that you're talking about is you slice an apple in half, you can see over time that it starts to turn brown, it decays. So I did a workshop with an energy-based physician, Leonard Lasker, quite a while ago. This was at least 30 years ago. What he does is cut it in half, put one half away, and then the circle of people in the workshop focus their attention on the other half of the apple. And I mean, maybe it sounds ridiculous, but you send feelings of love and appreciation to the apple. And you do that for like 10 minutes. I don't remember exactly. And then we did the rest of the workshop. And then an hour later, brought the two pieces together again. And the piece that we had appreciated did not decay to the same extent that the other one did. And you could say, it wasn't black and white, it was brown and brown and tawny, whatever. But it was a noticeable difference. And the only difference was how our energy had been applied to it. So this is something that can be studied in the lab. And there's quite a bit of research on healing at a distance, healing clinically with hands to project the energy across the room. There's
Excuse me,
some
I'm
really,
just closing this door. Keep going.
some really, really phenomenal studies by a fellow in New Jersey named Bill Bengston, who developed a hands-on energy thing that he's demonstrated in rats who are given cancer because they're exposed to a toxic chemical. It's a form of cancer that normally 100% mortality within a month. But when they're given this infection, it's not really infection, but and then are treated, none of them die. And he's done it in a replicated way with photos and pathology slides and everything. And there's zero explanation in mainstream medicine, but something happens in this between his hands and the rat's body that shows that there's something going on. So there's some very provocative findings out there. And the interactional stuff is really cool. That's why I got into the sports aspect of it when our local baseball team, the Boston Red Sox, have done terribly for a long, long time. And then finally it all came together in 19, like, when was it? 2004, sorry. And it was just very exciting. And it was not just for the fans getting excited and watching from home or at the stadium, but you could see how the players, their energy got jazzed up too. So I got very interested in that. I have a cousin who's a filmmaker, and we put together that film that you mentioned, The Joy of Socks, which is a documentary about group energies in sports, because we were able to, we could cameras to the game and interview players, and they talk about the fan energy and how it brings them up, and the fans talk about how they love getting swept up in it. But we also did a couple of measurements to assess what's the nature of this energy. And one of the coolest experiments was actually in a lab. It wasn't at Fenway Park, but it was about the effect of someone else's emotion on my heart rhythm. The way it was set up, I was literally a guinea pig because I was blindfolded. So I was in sensory isolation, and my finger, they were measuring my pulse to see what's called the heart rate variability was. And the terminology, this is from the Institute of Heart Math, the terminology I used was whether my heart rate was coherent or not. And I didn't know their technique, so my heart rate was not coherent at the time. But then four meditators came and sat behind me, and on a signal from the director, they started this meditation. And within a few seconds, my heart rhythm shifted into this coherent state. even though I didn't consciously know how to do it, I didn't consciously know that they were doing anything different or that they were even there. So a lot happened. There's something in that space that transmitted it that wasn't through my, cognitive powers at all. And we filmed this for the video. So people who are interested, there's probably the best way is to, there's a website for my book that has all this information. It's called www.themysteryoflifeenergy.com. And there's a tab called resources, and you can scroll down, you can watch the whole movie. It's about 60 minutes, but you can watch the segment of the emotional entrainment, because that's the terminology. But it was like I was a tuning fork, and my emotions resonated to the tuning fork of the guys behind me when they started vibrating in that frequency. And we've all experienced it. You go into a room and you can tell if everybody's really happy or if everybody
Oh,
is.
absolutely. I can feel the energy.
Yeah. So that's what it is. Some people are very sensitive to it, like it sounds like you are. And other people, there are people who are oblivious. And to each his own. But I think that's what was going on, that there's ways of demonstrating it. So that was a really important finding that we came across and worked on.
What I've found in my practice over the years is that anybody who grew up in a highly stressful as a child, highly stressful environment as a child, had to become energetically sensitive because that was a survival skill. And so most people that I work with who are coming from that, they're adults now, in addition to the damage that's been done to them emotionally and psychologically, physically, nervous system. There's also the energetic sensitivity that makes it really difficult for them to be around other people. So, but it is a survival skill that we gain in childhood. When you were talking about the, feeling that energy and having it change you, I was thinking back to when my son was a toddler, and I had just learned TM, and I would put him on the floor in the room where I was meditating and then go into the transcendental meditation, and he would just sleep and relax. It was the coolest thing.
That's really cool. That's very cool.
It was really cool, So I know he was picking up on the energy in the room. It was very interesting.
Pets do that too. So pets and more attuned than adults. So we get it trained out of us. So hopefully train that out of him.
I mean, he's pretty open. I mean, he's a surgeon, but he's also pretty open to like energy and meditation and all these kind of things. So hopefully he will begin to integrate them at some point. And when you were talking about the sports team, it made me think about like during COVID when there were no fans, and these teams were playing to no fans. How did that affect them?
Yeah, that's an interesting piece that I looked into. The players usually didn't like it, because they like getting caught up in this energy, and it felt like, it's the same as the musicians when they're performing in front of an audience versus when they're just in a studio. And performance was affected by the presence or absence of the fan energy. And there were some studies in like the German soccer league and things like that. Things like the home field advantage dissipated because there were no fans cheering for you. And but in some settings, I think it was snooker, which is the British form of billiards pool. In the championships that particular year, without fans, the players scored longer runs than usual
Oh,
because
really?
they didn't have the anxiety of performing in front of a crowd. So. Because you don't cheer in that setting, so it was
Okay.
an internal thing. So it works both ways, and fortunately that experiment is over with, and fans can come back and watch the games.
And in tennis, everybody's got to be so quiet, and a little bit of disturbance can it change the whole game. So, I don't remember if I read about this in your book, but I wanted to just bring in the idea of prayer. That energy. Have you looked into that, or do you have an opinion on how prayer affects energy?
Well, within the person, who's doing the praying. I think it's just a direct, body, mind, spirit. The part that's more puzzling is distant prayer, intercessory prayer. And there have been studies on that. Also, the first one came out like 40 years ago or something, that patients in a cardiac unit who were prayed for, who didn't know whether they were being prayed for or not, they recovered quicker and fewer medications and things like that. Other attempts to replicate it have not been successful. Some have, some haven't. And, it's a whole question of what the protocol and how you set it up. There are some large scale group meditations. It's not praying for someone else, but meditating together as a group that has effects on other people. And as a TM person, you may have come across a study that was done in Washington, D.C. Again, I quite a while ago now, it's at least 30 years ago, where they had a big gathering in the course of a couple of weeks. I think it was a month. Several thousand people coming together to meditate at the same time together, which is, that happens a lot, that you have group meditations. But what they did was also tracking the crime rate in Washington, D.C. during those weeks. And they
Wow.
found as more and more people gathered to join the meditation, the crime rate went down. And then when the retreat ended, the crime rate went back up. And it went down by like 25%. So it was not just some little blip. So, part of it was just a coincidence and it was spring break or whatever, trying to find some other explanation for it. But this was what the statistics bore out, that the TM people talk about there being some sort of group field, consciousness field. And they call it the Maharishi effect. If a certain number of people are in this meditative state, it influences the whole field of everybody who's there, whether they even know about it or not. And so that's the kind of thing that would, I think, it'd be really important to study more. Crime rate is one effect that you can measure. There are also computerized systems called random number generators that respond to human thought. In the Joe Sox movie, there's also a clip about measuring fan energy at the ballpark, where the people are not next to the computer, but around it. And then there were also some global studies that have been done with literally a network of computers around the world monitoring continuously 24/7 and showing that during times of important big events, the computers show something, even though they're not anywhere near the event itself. Those
What do
are,
they show? What do they show?
well, what the computer is basically doing is flipping a coin, instead of heads and tails, it generates ones and zeros 1,000 times a second and in a random fashion. So there'll always be some, a little bit more ones, a little bit more zeros, but not much of a variation. What the Princeton researchers found in the lab was that if somebody sits next to the computer and meditates at the computer, they can change the flow to be more ones and more zeros,
Wow, that's really cool.
which shouldn't happen because, your brain is here and the computer's there and there's empty space. So, what's going on is a very important question. So they developed software to put in a computer so that you could take it anywhere outside of the lab. And they've done tests at like Burning Man, my test at the baseball game. And then they have this network around the world that shows really big deviations from randomness. That's what it is. It deviates from randomness in a more coherent direction. One annual experiment is what's called World Sound Healing Day. It's developed by sound healer Jonathan and Andy Goldman, and they have coordinated so that people around the world on a particular day, which they choose to be Valentine's Day, find a way of expressing heartfelt emotions through sound. And it could be singing a song, it could be humming, it could be chanting, toning, whatever you want. But during this particular day, as many participants around the world do it, at the same time, this network of computers is measuring what happens. And I don't think I have it handy, but there's a where is it? Oh, I know. And on my book's website, under the it was a picture of the graph under highlights that shows how on that particular day, that particular year, there was a huge variation from randomness during the time when people were doing it. And there's no reason it should happen because computers are there and people are miles and miles away. So something is connecting us at a even more intangible level. It's hard to even find words for it because it's not like, energy. If you're in the same room with somebody, you can imagine your magnetic field goes that far. But those fields don't they dissipate after 10 or 15 feet. So there's some other level, even more subtle, that connects people, and it's a mind field of some sort. And there's models that use quantum physics that, honestly, between you and me, I don't understand, but it seems to well, that's one way of talking about it. And I don't know what it is, but it
Right.
does seem real.
Think the overall message here is that we really need to be aware of the energy we're putting out there, and the energy we allow ourselves to be around.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's sort of a version of that called energy hygiene, which you learn to clear up your own biofield, your own energy field. And you can literally remove toxic stuff that has been embedded from earlier in your life when you weren't able to handle it any differently. And you can replace it with the more authentic energy. So that's a very useful tool as well.
Yeah, it really is. And so, for people that are keeping themselves in toxic environments, thinking that they can think their way or just maybe just adjust to it cognitively, mentally, nervous system wise, I think it's really important for people to understand the energy around them is very important to their health and their well-being, and really not just theirs, but really the overall, because there's this ripple effect with our
No,
energy.
that's a great word, that great image. The ripple effect is that you whatever you're putting out, it does affect other people. It could be this benevolent, helpful, healing stuff, but we see a lot of negativity being rippled out there too these days, and so it's important to be able to ride the waves.
Yeah, I mean that's my way of dealing with the craziness in this world is just to ripple out good energy and light, positive things, ripple it out instead of trying to fight against it, do battle with
Yeah,
it.
I think that's the common mentality is to fight against it, but that puts you in that same adversarial
And the
form
other,
of.
the last thing I wanted to just bring up because we're pretty much out of time was energetic imprints of history, because I know that when things happen, it leaves an imprint in that particular area, right?
Well, so they say. I personally haven't experienced it that directly, but I know some people who are so sensitive, they can be brought to a place and tell you what happened
Right.
because it's almost as though they can read the history of it. But
Right.
there are certain places where anybody can feel something special. There's something special about this place. I happen to, because my wife is British, I've had the opportunity to go to England a lot and have been drawn to places like Stonehenge and Avebury, where the stone circles have either created or are markers for something really unique in the landscape there. And there's different theories about that. One really interesting aspect of it is that in recent years in that part of southern England, it has a lot of these stone circles. They're not all huge like Stonehenge, there are a lot of smaller ones too. But they've also started to notice patterns in the wheat fields that appear overnight. Because some of the wheat is down and some of it's up, it's called crop circles, and that's a very unusual phenomenon. It's very hard to explain. Actually, as I'm looking at, I can see over my shoulder here. This is a calendar with that month's. Can't point properly, but that month's
Right.
crop circle pattern. So they're very complicated geometric shapes. They're like 100 yards across that just appear overnight. And what is it about the energy of that part of the world that facilitates those kind of things to happen? I do
Don't
not know.
know. I don't know. I mean, they say it's, UFO influence, but nobody sees it happening. So how do we know? So, Well, very interesting conversation, Rick. Okay, so we're talking about the mystery of, sorry for all my little thingies, but this just shows you that I read these books. So this is the book we're talking about. Very, very interesting. If you're, if this is a topic that sparks your interest, you want to pick up a copy of this. And you said the website is the Mystery of Life Energy. What is your website again? Say it.
TheMysteryOfLifeEnergy.com, and
Easy.
there are a lot of resources on it, including the ability to sign up to get blog posts, because I update pretty frequently about subtle energy aspects of everyday life. Like I've just written a couple about the eclipse that we just had. I don't know if you had it in Florida, but so yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's great talking to you. Thank you.
You're
Really
welcome.
interesting conversation. I enjoyed it.
I enjoy the conversation too. Thank you very much, Randy.
Yeah. So have a wonderful day. And greatly appreciate your work. Really great.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Okay. Bye-bye.